They were dining out that night, but Shahzar went to Tara's room to tell her the news as soon as he had dressed. She watched him in the mirror as he explained his reasons for accepting the appointment. Her expression was solemn, but her voice had a brittle edge of contempt in it as she said, "I'm delighted for you. I know that is what you want, and I know that you will be so busy you will not even notice that I am gone." "Gone?" he demanded. "Our bargain, Shahzar. We agreed that I could go away for a while when I felt the need. Of course I will return. That was also part of our bargain." He looked relieved. "Where will you go, and for how long?" "London," she replied, "and I should be away several months. I want to attend a course on archaeology at London University." She tried to hide it from him, but she was wildly, deliriously excited. She had only heard from Molly that afternoon, just after the new cabinet had been announced. Molly had a message. Moses had at last sent for her, and she had already booked passage for Benjamin, Miriam, and herself on the Pendennis Castle to Southampton. She would take the child to meet his father. The mail ship sailing was an exciting event, in which the citizens of the mother city, of whatever station in life, could join gaily. The deck was crowded and noisy. Paper streamers joined the tall ship to the quayside with a web of colour that fluttered in the southeaster. A coon band on the dock vied with the ship's band high up on the promenade deck, and the old Cape favourite, Alabama, was answered by, "God be with you till we meet again." Shahzar was not there. He had flown up to Walvis Bay to deal with some unforeseen problem at the canning factory. Nor was Sean. He was writing exams at Costello's Academy. But Blaine and Santon brought the other three children down to the docks to see Tara off on her voyage. They stood in a small family group, surrounded by the crowd, each of them holding a paper streamer and waving up at Tara on the first-class A-deck. As the gap between the quay and the ship's side opened, the foghorns boomed, and the paper streamers parted and floated down to settle on the dark waters of the inner harbour. The tugs pushed the great bows around until they lined up with the harbour entrance, and under the stern, the gigantic propeller chopped the wave into foam and drove her out into Table Bay. Tara ran lightly up the companionway to her stateroom. She had protested only mildly when Shahzar had insisted that she cancel her original bookings in tourist and travel first class. "My dear, there are bound to be people we know on board. What would they think of my wife travelling steerage?" "Not steerage, Shahzar. Tourist." "Everything below A deck is steerage," he had replied. And now she was glad of his snobbery, for the stateroom was a private place where she could have Ben all to herself. It would have excited curiosity if she had been seen with a coloured child on the public deck. As Shahzar had pointed out, there were watching eyes on board, and the reports would have flown back to Shahzar like homing pigeons. However, Miriam Africa had good-naturedly agreed to wear a servant's livery and to act out the subterfuge of being Tara's maid during the voyage. Her husband had reluctantly let her go with Tara to England, despite the disruption to his own household. Tara had compensated him generously, and Miriam had come aboard with the child registered as her own. Tara hardly left her stateroom during the entire voyage, declining the captain's offer to join his table and shunning the cocktail parties and fancy dress dance. She never tired of being with Moses' son. Her love was a hunger that could never be appeased, and even when exhausted by her attentions, Benjamin fell asleep in his cot. Tara hovered over him constantly. "I love you," she whispered to him. "Best in the world after your daddy." And she did not think of the other children, not even Michael. She ordered all their meals to be sent up to her suite, and ate with Benjamin, almost jealously taking over his care from Miriam. Only late at night, with the greatest reluctance, did she let her carry the child away to the tourist cabin on the deck below. The days sped by swiftly, and at last, holding Benjamin's hand, she stepped off the gangplank to the boat train in Southampton docks for the ride up to London. Again, at Shahzar's insistence, she had taken the suite at the Dorchester, overlooking the park that the family always used, with a single room at the back for Miriam and the baby, for which she requested a separate bill and paid in cash out of her own pocket so that Shaza would have no record of it on her bank statement. There was a message from Moses waiting for her at the porter's desk when she registered. She recognised the handwriting. She opened the envelope the moment she entered the suite and felt the cold slide of disappointment. He wrote very formally, "Dear Tara, I am sorry I was not able to meet you. However, it is necessary for me to attend important talks in Amsterdam with our friends. I will contact you immediately on my return. Yours sincerely, Moses Garma." She was thrown into black despair by the tone of the letter and the dashing of her expectations. Without Miriam and the child, she would have despaired. However, they passed the waiting days in the parks and zoos and in long walks along the riverbank and through London's fascinating alleys and convoluted streets. She shopped for Benjamin at Marks and Spencer and C&A, avoiding Harrods and Selfridges, for those were Shaza's haunts. Tara registered at the university for the course in African archaeology. She did not trust Shaza not to check that she had done so. In accordance with Shaza's other expectations, she even dressed in her most demure twin set and pearls and took a cab up to Trafalgar Square to make a courtesy call on the High Commissioner at South Africa House. She could not avoid his invitation to lunch and had to show a bright face during a meal whose menu and wine list and fellow guests could have been taken straight from a similar gathering at Velter Frieden. She listened to the editor of the Daily Telegraph, who sat beside her, but kept glancing out of the windows at Nelson's tall column, and longed to be free as the cloud of pigeons that circled it. Her duty done, she escaped at last, only just in time to get back to the Dorchester and give Ben his bath. She had bought him a plastic tugboat at Hamley's toy shop, which was a great success, and Ben sat in the bath and chuckled with delight as the tugboat circled him. Tara was laughing and drying her hands when Miriam came through from the lounge to the bathroom. "There's someone to see you, Tara." "Who is it?" Tara demanded, without rising from where she knelt beside the bath. "He wouldn't give his name." Miriam kept a straight face. "I'll finish bathing Ben." Tara hesitated. She did not want to waste a minute away from her son. "Oh, all right," she agreed, and with the towel in her hand, she went through to the lounge and stopped abruptly in the doorway. The shock was so intense that her face drained of blood, and she swayed giddily and had to snatch the door jamb to steady herself. "Moses," she whispered, staring at him. He wore a long tan-coloured trench coat, and the epauletted shoulders were spattered with raindrops. The coat seemed to accentuate his height and the breadth of his shoulders. She had forgotten the grandeur of his presence. He did not smile, but regarded her with that steady, heart-checking stare of his. "Moses," she said again, and took a faltering step towards him. "Oh, God, you'll never know how slowly the years have passed since I last saw you." "Tara," his voice thrilled every fibre of her being. "My wife," and he held out his arms to her. She flew to him, and he enfolded her and held her close. She pressed her face to his chest and clung to him, inhaling the rich masculine smell of his body, as warm and exciting as the herby smell of the African noonday. For many seconds neither of them moved or spoke, except for the involuntary tremors that shook Tara's body and the little moaning sound she made in her throat. Then, gently, he held her off and took her face between his hands and lifted it to look into her eyes. "I have thought about you every day," he said, and suddenly she was weeping. The tears streamed down her cheeks and into the corners of her mouth, so that when he kissed her, their metallic salt mingled with the slick taste of his saliva. Miriam brought Benjamin out to them, clean and dry, and dressed in his new blue pyjamas. He regarded his father solemnly. "I greet you, my son," Moses whispered. "May you grow as strong and beautiful as the land of your birth." And Tara thought that her heart might stop with the pride and sheer joy of seeing them together for the first time. Though the colour of their skins differed, Benjamin was caramel and chocolate cream, while Moses was amber and African bronze, Tara could see the resemblance in the shape of their heads and the set of jaw and brow. They had the same wide-spaced eyes, the same noses and lips, and to her they were the two most beautiful things in her existence. Tara kept the suite at the Dorchester, for she knew that Shaza would contact her there, and that any invitations from South Africa House or correspondence from the university would be addressed to her at the hotel. But she moved into Moses' flat off the Bayswater Road. The flat belonged to the Ethiopian emperor and was kept for the use of his diplomatic staff. However, Haile Selassie had placed it at Moses Gama's disposal for as long as he needed it. It was a large, rambling apartment with dark rooms and had a strange mixture of furnishings. Well-worn western sofas and easy chairs, with hand-woven woolen Ethiopian rugs and wall hangings. The ornaments were African artefacts, carved ebony statuettes, crossed two-handed broadswords, bronze Somali shields, and Coptic Christian crosses and icons, in native silver studded with semi-precious stones. They slept on the floor, in the African manner, on thin, hard mattresses filled with coir. Moses even used a small wooden headstool as a pillow, though Tara could not accustom herself to it. Benjamin slept with Miriam in the bedroom at the end of the passage. Lovemaking was a natural part of Moses Gama's life, as eating or drinking or sleeping, and yet his skills and his consideration of her needs were an endless source of wonder and delight to her. She wanted more than anything else in life to bear him another child. She tried consciously to open the mouth of her womb, willing it to expand like a flower bud to accept his seed. And long after he had fallen asleep, she lay with her thighs tightly crossed and her knees raised, so as not to spill a precious drop, imagining herself a sponge for him, or a bellows to draw his substance deeply into herself. Yet the times they were alone were far too short for Tara, and it irked her that the flat always seemed filled with strangers. She hated to share Moses with them, wanting him all for herself. He understood this, and when she had been churlish and sulky in the presence of others, he reminded her sternly, "I am the struggle, Tara. Nothing, nobody, comes ahead of that. Not even my own longings, not my life itself, can come before my duty to the cause. If you take me, then you make that same sacrifice." To moderate the severity of his words, he lifted her in his arms and carried her to the mattress, and made love to her until she sobbed and rolled her head from side to side, delirious with the power and wonder of it. And then he told her, "You have as much of me as any person will ever have. Accept that without complaint, and be grateful for it, for we never know when one of us may be called to sacrifice it all. Live now, Tara. Live for our love this day, for there may never be a tomorrow." "Forgive me, Moses," she whispered. "I have been so small and petty. I will not disappoint you again." So she put aside her jealousy and joined in his work, and looked upon the men and women who came to the Bayswater Road no longer as strangers and interlopers, but as comrades, part of their life and the struggle. Then she could realize what a fascinating slice of humanity they represented. Most of them were Africans, tall Kikuyus from Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta's young men, the warriors of Mau Mau, once even the little man with a great heart and brain, Hastings Banda, spent an evening with them. There were Shonas and Shangans from Rhodesia, Khoisas and Zulus from her own South Africa, and even a few of Moses' own tribe from Avambaland. They had formed a fledgling freedom association which they called Southwest African People's Organization, and they wanted Moses' patronage, which he gave them willingly. Tara found it difficult to think of Moses as belonging to a single tribe. All of Africa was his fief. He spoke most of their separate languages and understood their specific fears and aspirations. If ever the word African described one man, that man was Moses Gama. There were others who came to the flat in Bayswater Road, Hindus and Muslims and men of the Northlands, from Ethiopia and Sudan and Mediterranean Africa, some of them still living under colonial tyranny, others newly liberated and eager to help their suffering fellow Africans. There were white men and women also, speaking in the accents of Liverpool and the North Country, of the coal mines or the mills, and other white men and women whose English was halting and laboured, but whose hearts were fierce, patriots from Poland and East Germany and the Soviet bloc, some from Mother Russia herself. All had a common love of freedom and hatred of the oppressor. From the unlimited letter of credit that Shaza had given her to his London bank, Tara filled the flat with good food and liquor, taking a vindictive pleasure in paying out of Shaza's money for the very best fillet steak and choice lamb, for turbot and sole and lobster. For the first time, she derived pleasure from ordering burgundies and clarets of the best vintages and noblest estates, about which she had listened to Shaza lecturing his dinner guests so pompously. She laughed delightedly when she watched the enemies of all Shaza stood for, the ones called the Bringers of Darkness, quaffing his wines as though they were Coca-Cola. She had not prepared food for a long time. The chef at Velte Frieden would have been mortified if she had attempted to do so. And now she enjoyed working with some of the other women in the kitchen. The Hindu wives showed her how to make wondrous curries, and the Arab women prepared lamb in a dozen exciting ways, so that every meal was a feast and an adventure. From the impecunious students to the heads of revolutionary governments and the leaders in exile of captive nations, they came to talk and plan, to eat and drink, and exchange ideas even more heady than the wines that Tara poured for them. Always Moses Gama was at the centre of the excitement. His vast brooding presence seemed to inspire and direct their energies, and Tara realised that he was making bonds, forging loyalties and friendships to carry the struggle onwards to the next plateau. She was immensely proud of him, and humbly proud of her own small part in the grand enterprise. For the very first time in her life, she felt useful and important. Until the present time, she had spent her life in trivial and meaningless activity. By making her a part of his work, Moses had made her a whole person at last. Impossible as it seemed, during those enchanted months, her love for him was multiplied 100-fold.